Good morning. Thanks, Bruce, and thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning to talk about something about which I'm pretty passionate. I'm going to talk for about an hour and 15 minutes. I'd like it to be interactive. Stop me if you'd like to ask questions or engage in dialogue. I'm also going to ask to facilitate communication that you turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate so we can speak with each other rather than multitask, which I know is the way we usually manage our day. As has been true in previous years, Bruce gave me this title, and has been true in previous years. Last week, I started to wonder what it meant. And I decided what it meant was that we should spend some time first understanding the problem of safety and quality in surgical pathology. Second, we're going to spend a little bit of time trying to understand the value of systems-based thinking in addressing challenges in safety and quality when it comes to surgical pathology. And I'd like to finish by spending some time talking about some specific solutions to problems that are common in surgical pathology, quality, and safety. So that's the plan. We're only going to do three things. How many of you have seen this report? How many of you have read this report? I think there are very few reports that have changed the rules of engagement in the way that this report did, published in November of 1999 from the Institute of Medicine. It was entitled "To Air as Human, Building a Safer Health System." And this really energized the national dialogue about safety and subsequently quality in healthcare delivery. And the authors said that the goal of this report was to break the cycle of our inaction. And they warned us that they would accept no excuses. They said, despite the cost pressures, liability constraints, resistance to change, and other seemingly insurmountable barriers, it is simply not acceptable for patients to be harmed by the very healthcare system that is supposed to offer healing and comfort. There would be no excuses. They executed their strategy using a number of tactics. One was to tell some frightening stories. And stories aren't data, but they caught the public's attention. They told the story of Betsy Lehman, a health reporter for the Boston Globe. Health is what she did as a reporter, and she died from an overdose during chemotherapy for breast cancer at a well-known cancer center. They told the story of Willie King, who had the wrong leg amputated. Since then, physicians have pointed out that Willie King had problems with both legs and was probably going to lose both of them eventually, as if losing the wrong one on this day was actually not so bad. And they told the story of Ben Kolb, an 8-year-old who went in for one of multiple surgeries on his ears, and he got epinephrine instead of topical lidocaine, and it killed him in the OR. Minor surgical procedure by a well-intended surgeon. In addition to stories, this report put together some facts and figures. The initial response from medicine was to dispute the facts and the figures, realizing that that didn't sound very constructive. That dialogue shifted. But the report said, drawing on two studies, one in New York State, one in Colorado, that 44,000 to 98,000 Americans die each year from preventable medical errors, somewhere between 50 and 100,000. To put that in perspective, they said that medical errors exceeded the number of deaths attributable to the eighth leading cause of death, meaning that medical errors were responsible for more deaths than motor vehicle accidents, breast cancer, or AIDS. And none of those seemed like small problems in the eyes of the public. And to catch the Fed's attention, they said this cost money, somewhere between $17 and $29 billion annually. And that was at a time when $29 billion sounded like a lot of money. And I think the response from pathology was, thank God they're not talking about us. But guess what? They were talking about us. And that's become very clear since November of 1999 in a variety of ways. Good Housekeeping, April of 2001, big font said, "When doctors make mistakes," sounds like the sort of title where they ought to be talking about plastic surgeons or anesthesiologists, maybe obstetricians. After all, it is good housekeeping. But instead, they were talking about pathologists. And in fact, the author said that she was going to tell five chilling real-life stories, chilling stories from the laboratory. Who knew? One of the stories she told was a lost specimen. The surgeon called Kastrup, that was the patient, into her office and confessed the lymph nodes had never made it to the lab. Word was out. We lose specimens. Anybody seen a lost specimen? or failed to see a lost specimen? Anybody lost a specimen in your lab? I have. Good housekeeping. October 2008, lost specimens, back in the news, Chicago Sun-Times. This time, a pediatric patient. That gets people's attention. Little girl whose thyroid never made it to the lab. They couldn't tell her if she had thyroid cancer or not. That's going to cost some money. August 2006, Reader's Digest. The most widely circulated general interest magazine in the world. 80 million copies, over 20 languages. My parents read it. 86 and 79, that's what folks of their generation rely on, right? There's always a Reader's Digest on the bedside table. Anybody read Reader's Digest? How many of your parents read Reader's Digest? A few more. Reader's Digest had some interesting headlines. Number one, Secret to a Sharper Brain. My parents were interested in that. 5 Ways to Spot a Liar. Important. A little bit about Iran. But the big central story was how doctors gamble with your life. 7 Ways to Protect Yourself. A manual to protect yourself from doctors. And guess who they were talking about? They were talking about us. If you read the subtext under the title, millions of medical mistakes happen in the lab. Here's how to protect yourself. And they told the world about floaters. Floaters, the sort of thing that I thought could remain our little secret, right? Instead, I have to answer my parents who say, Jeff, what's about these floaters? Should we be concerned? And the world learned that sometimes we confuse patient identification. This headline appeared in the local Rochester paper while I was still working at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. This was front page news on the weekend paper. Hospital apologizes for removing women's breasts. Now, that's a headline that will catch your attention. And it turns out that they had switched 2 patients. And this patient who didn't have cancer got a cancer diagnosis and had bilateral mastectomy. It happened in St. Paul, but it happens everywhere. This made it more personal for me. These were the headlines in Ann Arbor after I moved there, April 24th, 2007, telling about a patient identification mix-up in our laboratory. Same mishap, patient got a surgery she didn't need for a cancer diagnosis she didn't have, and it cost the University of Michigan $3 million. October, same year, it was happening in the Northeast. So the world knows a lot of our dirty little secrets, and the Institute of Medicine report was all about us. And more, safety is not the only problem. If it had just been safety, maybe we had a shot. But the next Institute of Medicine report, released in March of 2001, said that patient safety is just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, our expectation is that you'll tackle the whole iceberg. And the whole iceberg is about changing the way we deliver care in very substantial ways. The authors of this report, again from the Institute of Medicine, said, between the healthcare we have and the care we could have lies not just a gap, but a chasm. As the patient safety report was a call for action to make care safer, this report is a call for action to improve the American healthcare delivery system as a whole, in all of its quality dimensions for all Americans. What does that mean? They meant that healthcare should be not only safe, which we already heard about, but it needs to be effective, meaning we avoid underuse and overuse. It has to be patient-centered. It's about them, not us. It has to be timely. That speaks to us. It has to be efficient, and it has to be equitable. Every patient gets treated the same. We don't have one turnaround time for your relatives and another turnaround time for everybody else. And they pointed out that this was actually an issue of systems and not people. They said if we want safer, higher quality care, we will need to have redesigned systems of care, including the use of information technology to support clinical and administrative processes, and that's what Lab Infotech is all about. So let's talk a little bit more about our second goal, understanding the value of systems-based thinking in addressing challenges in safety and quality in surgical pathology in particular. There are lots of ways that you can define and think about errors. This is a way we talked about at last year's Lab Infotech Summit, where you can think of errors as occurring in 2 main categories. Active errors, which are those that occur at the level of the frontline operator. And I would submit that our historical quality assurance programs in surgical pathology have assumed that this was the enemy. Active errors are those that occur at the interface between healthcare and the monitored process. Dr. Woods and associates describe this as the sharp end of complex healthcare systems. I think what we've come to understand is that the real enemy are the latent errors, those removed from the frontline operator, certainly removed from their direct control, and they really reflect poor design, poorly structured organizations, etc. If you will, this is the blunt end of a complex healthcare system. We are designed to fail. And the question is, can we redesign in a way that ensures greater success? Don Berwick from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement says, every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. If your quality assurance program says that through whatever process you identify errors in 0.05% of your cases, that's exactly what you're designed to achieve. And viewed as a percentage, that's comforting. View it as real numbers, it's less so. Depending on the denominator, you could preside over 10 to 20 catastrophes annually and be happy about it without taking a systems approach. And the truth is, our systems are complex. This is an idealized schematic of a simple specimen making its way through a surgical pathology process, and it's complex. We can think of it in terms of pre-analytical, analytical, and post-analytical phases, which overlap. And many of those steps occur as if they're discrete processes in silos that don't speak to one another. We operate in a complex system that is designed to fail at a predictable but low rate. So what are some of the specific solutions that we can gain from a data-driven approach to solving problems in surgical pathology, quality, and safety? And that's where we're going to spend the bulk of our time. That's really the point of this morning's workshop. And I want to begin by thinking about pre-analytical phase errors, those that occur upfront in the process, beginning with acquisition of the specimen. You could argue even before that. You could argue even with the decision to acquire a specimen. Transportation of that specimen, receiving, and accessioning is really the interface between the pre-analytical and the analytical phase. There is surprisingly little data about the risks in surgical pathology when it comes to the pre-analytical phase of what we do. In 1996, Rolf Nockley and Dick Zarbo published data that was collected in 1993 using a CAPQ probes design. It included 417 participating laboratories, 393 from the U.S. And this was limited to surgical tissue cases, so it's relevant to our dialogue this morning. And each participating laboratory collected information on either 4,000 sequential accessions, all of the cases received in 4 months, or up until they collected data on 400 deficiency, whichever one of those three came first. And when they looked at the rates of deficiencies, they found deficiencies in 6% of just over a million cases. 60,000 deficiencies in just over a million cases. 6% of cases had deficiencies, not all with the same implications for patient safety and quality, but some very serious and interesting dilemmas in this very large data set. The largest piece of the pie by far were cases that came to us with incomplete or missing information. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. 10% of the cases were those in which there was a problem with specimen identification. Remember the headlines about mixing up patients and the consequences, how it earns you a spot on the front page? And when pathologists read those headlines, they think, thank God it didn't happen to me. When the January headline came out and I was still in Rochester, it was interesting because that preceded the annual quality conference at Mayo, which began that Monday. When I walked into the conference room, a lot of leaders, the chair of surgery, came up to me and said, did you read the paper? Of course. They said, and that couldn't happen here, right? What do you say? 10% of the time, we don't get that part right. If we look at the 77%, the biggest piece of the pie, those in which there were information defects, the largest group, just over 50%, were those in which there was no history or diagnosis, although the tissue site was identified. The next largest group were those without a procedure date, probably not a critical piece of information. The third largest group were those in which we didn't know where the specimen was from, and together those three accounted for 80% of the problem. If we look at the identification defects, those that might pose the greatest risk, 27% were illegible. We couldn't tell what the specimen was or from who it came or who the submitting doc was. No label was the second biggest category. Together, they accounted for almost half. So either illegible or no label, we had no clue what we had received. A number of other studies have looked at identification problems both in the clinical laboratory and in surgical pathology. This is data from Paul Valenstein that included both clinical laboratory and surgical pathology specimens. He identified over 6,700 identification errors in this large data set and noted that the vast majority were identified before reporting. The sorts of identification errors identified before reporting occurred at a rate of 324 per million billable tests and accounted for 85% of the problem. We breathe a sigh of relief. Sure, it's risky, but we catch them. If you look at the number identified after reporting, that was about 15% of the experience, a rate at 55 per million billable tests. And if you look at the number of adverse events, it was 345, or 1 in 18. So 10% of cases have an identification problem. 1 in 20 or so of those result in mishap. It is not a small problem. When he looked at the reasons for the identification errors, he could ferret that out in just under 5,000 of the over 6,000 cases, and the largest group were problems with the specimen label, just like Ralph Nockley found in 1996. And the second largest group were problems at accessioning, if you will, initial registration or order entry. More recently, we've seen the problem from the eyes of the supplier. This is a study that actually comes from the Department of Surgery at Johns Hopkins that did a prospective cohort study. So it's not just pathologists who worry about this problem. And they looked at both an outpatient clinic and the hospital ORs, and they collected information on all patients for whom surgical specimens were sent to pathology in a six-month period, October 04 to April 05. And I think that's important because that's a time at which everybody was thinking about quality and safety, including Johns Hopkins. And their definition of an identification error were any cases in which there was discordance between the specimen requisition and the specimen label. So this is a very narrow view of error. Certainly doesn't capture the whole playing field as defined by the previous studies that I've referenced. And what was interesting was that using this narrow definition, they found problems with identification in 91 of just over 21,000 cases for an error rate of 4.3 per 1,000 cases. And when they compared the experience in the OR to the experience in the clinical laboratories, they were different. And the risk seemed to be greater in the clinical laboratories, where the rate was 4.8 per 1,000 compared to 3.7 for the ORs. If you look at the types of problems that they identified, the largest group were those in which the specimen was simply not labeled. The second largest group, 17%, were cases in which the container was empty. That's a problem. An equally large group were those in which the laterality was incorrect. Things that we think of as rare, the sorts of things that get you on the front page of the newspaper, to which I told leadership at Mayo, nah, this probably couldn't happen here, are common problems. When they compared those specific issues between sites, there were some interesting differences, suggesting that solutions in one environment may not apply to another. So, for example, in the clinical outpatient areas, the largest risks were empty containers, incorrect laterality, incorrect sites, and incorrect patients. So I suspect at Johns Hopkins they're trying to figure that out in their outpatient procedure areas. I would submit that if that is where the bulk of your business comes from, you should be nervous. In the ORs, the problems were unlabeled specimens or specimens that came with no patient name or no tissue site. So solutions that might make sense in one environment may not apply to another. So those are the problems in terms of the pre-analytical phase. What are the solutions? If we go back to the 1996 Q-Probe study, they looked at those things that were associated with lower rates of defects, and it was interesting. Lower numbers of accession cases, in other words, smaller operations, were at lower risk. But the rates of defects were lower in those practices that had a plan, suggesting that having a plan makes a difference. And about two-thirds of the laboratories that participated had a plan, and a third didn't. So having a formal plan for error detection in specimen identification and accessioning has value. Those things associated with higher rates of defects, which I think are harder to understand, and the authors confess they didn't understand them, was receiving specimens and requisitions in unique second containers. That's the one that's hard to understand. And specimen containers labeled with only one identifier. That's easier to understand and is part of the driver for the Joint Commission's expectation that every patient will be identified with two unique identifiers. Digzarbo and others have shown us that you can do something about pre-analytical phase defects applying the tools of lean, applying the tools of manufacturing that were born at Ford, exported to Japan, and now come back. And in a number of papers, he and Rita D'Angelo have shown their success in applying these tools to both pre-analytical and analytical components of the testing cycle in surgical pathology. We've adopted a lean program in our own practice in Ann Arbor, and I put up this diagram simply to point out that lean is complex. Lean has multiple components. It has a foundation that has to do with your workforce, your methods, your technologies, your equipment, your materials, and fundamental or developing standardized work, a love for continuous improvement and learning, a way to level your workload, and the pillars that really help you get to your goals are just-in-time pacing and error-proofing your practice. So having a plan, thinking about lean and how it applies to our processes, some of the specific errors detected in the studies that I showed you suggest that perhaps provider order entry is part of our solution. And at least in the surgical pathology side of things, I think the clinical laboratory is ahead of us in this regard, very little work has been done to look at the impact of provider order entry on safety in surgical pathology. This is a study published a number of years ago that looked at the effects of provider order entry in a number of arenas, radiology, pharmacy, had very little information on pathology, but had a little. The only impact they showed was that it reduced turnaround time for reporting of laboratory results. Unclear whether or how that might relate to safety. It certainly addresses an issue of quality. Been a lot of interest in computer-assisted patient identification using barcoding or RFID. Again, not a lot of data in the peer-reviewed literature. This data comes from St. Jude's and really focuses on non-surgical pathology specimens, but shows very dramatically the effects of an electronic positive patient identification system, in this case barcoding, which really drove their rates of identification errors to virtually zero. Their data also points out, however, that that won't solve all of your problems, and that while using this system of electronic positive patient identification drove down their identification errors, it didn't do anything for the fact that they continue to receive unlabeled specimens. I think too often we assume that electronic solution will substitute for bad process. You've got to figure out your process first and then understand the extent to which electronic solutions apply. But applying an electronic solution to a bad process will only enrich your opportunity to gather data about your bad process. It won't fix it. Last year, I was talking a little bit about a collaborative project with a very innovative three-person group in Florida, Suncoast Pathology, and they've managed to apply bar-coded identification from the beginning to the end of their process, from the time of order entry through the histology laboratory, right up to sign-out. In fact, it's a truly paperless process. The only paper we saw in their sign-out room was the Wall Street Journal. We're busy implementing some components of the solution envisioned in Venice, Florida. I want to share with you the first phase of our process in this video. And what I'm going to show you are really two parts. First, I'm going to show you our current state, what accessioning looks like with our 20-year-old legacy LIS, PathNet. And then I'm going to show you the future state envisioned in this collaborative model that we're developing with Suncoast Pathology. So this is current state using our legacy system. So this is Debbie in a place we call Room 1. It's next to the ORs. A lot of things happen in this small room. We receive cases, we accession them, we gross them, we do frozens, and we sign out our general surgical pathology service. And Debbie is the best we have. She's great. She's been there for over 20 years. Now, our hope has been that if you have employees like Debbie, nothing bad ever happens, right? That's been our strategy. Just have enough Debbies, we'll be fine. Debbie's made mistakes, mistakes in quotes. We set her up to fail, and I'm going to show you how we set her up to fail with our current state. So she's accessioning the case in PathNet. We're going to go back and see the details, but you notice she's launched another window, and she's printed some labels. I'm just going to let you watch the process, because then we're going to go back and I'm going to show you some of the risks that I would argue we really didn't think much about before. You can tell how efficient she is, right? She's done this a zillion times. By the way, I don't know if your practice is like our practice, but you think our practice is as safe on the days Debbie's not there? We have a Debbie solution to our safety problem. But sometimes Debbie isn't there. In fact, sometimes that's the excuse I get when we have a problem. I'm told, well, Debbie wasn't there.
And that's it.
Okay, now we're going back. I'm going to show you more detail about the process. Here she is entering this fake specimen into our PathNet, so there's no risky patient identification information here. It's a fake specimen. It's supposed to be a left breast and a sentinel node, entering it into PathNet. And PathNet's actually generating the labels, the ones up there that you saw. We'll go back to those. I'm not a very good film editor, by the way. I'm sure I could have distilled this down to a couple of minutes, but it's not my skill set. Now she's launched the other software. Notice she keys in the patient identification information to generate cassettes, and we hope that she keyed it in right. She almost always does. She takes the labels. Notice how many she gets. Four, because you always get four, right? If you need six, you get eight. If you need nine, you get 12. And on a good day, it's not too busy, she'll remember to do the next step, which you'll see, which is to throw those other labels away. On a bad day, she may not, and those labels might end up on another specimen. I know, because it happened. Now, this is a different area. This is Mary Jo. Mary Jo competes with Debbie as our best employee. Been there as many years. She works in a different area. We call it room two. Not quite as much commotion, although there can be. You'll notice there's a window there, and you'll see people walking by. It's a public thoroughfare. And she's pretty good. She knows PathNet pretty well. She's accessioning the same sort of specimen, same fake specimen, all this filmed by John Perrin, our QA coordinator. But this is our future state. You'll notice that the cassette printer to her left is different than the SureMark printer in the previous video. This is our new device as we move toward just-in-time cassette generation happening at the grossing station. But this is our first step in that direction. The way she enters it into PathNet is the very same way that Debbie did, but after that it's completely different when it comes to generating labels and cassettes, as you'll see. She's about as fast as Debbie. We've never actually run them side by side. But room two has a Mary Jo solution, right? If we have a screw-up, often the first thing I'm told is, but Mary Jo wasn't there. We have kind of two levels of safety, Mary Jo days and Mary Jo absent days. She's now launched new software designed by Yul Belis and others, linked to these new cassette recorders. What you're unable to see, but you'll see in a moment when I show you greater detail, is that she hasn't had to enter any patient identifying information because it's automatically populated from PathNet. She doesn't rekey any patient identification information. In fact, what you also can't see is that this software only allows one patient on the screen at a time, and it cannot conflict with the patients in PathNet. And that was built on our understanding of some of our sentinel events. What you may also notice is that she got exactly three labels, because that's what she needed. And if she needed five, she'd get five. And if she needed nine, she'd get nine. And the only thing to throw away is the wrapper. There are no labels. So this simply takes you through that in greater detail, and I think in the interest of time, we're not going to do that. So I think we have to get better at understanding how software solutions can address some of our upfront difficulties in patient registration. So in terms of specific countermeasures for the pre-analytical errors that we can generate either from our own quality assurance data or from what's known in the literature, first have a plan. a formal written plan for error detection and problem resolution. Think about lean and what it might bring to the table in terms of better design process. The role of provider order entry is really a topic for future state discussion. Electronic positive patient identification no doubt can impact patient identification errors, but it can't substitute if you still have bad process. And software solutions that maintain fidelity of the patient identification across key handoffs. Historically, when we think about errors in surgical pathology, we have tended to focus on the analytical phase of our process. In fact, I would argue we've tended to focus on just one part of this complex process. We've tended to focus on this part. As if it was an active error, the problem is really pathologists gone bad, pathologists unable to make a diagnosis. And I think what we've learned is there are multiple risks in this complex process. And in fact, surgical pathology is without a doubt a team activity. That's actually reflected in data that Dr. Troxell published a number of years ago, drawing from pathology claims reported to the doctor's company, at that time a physician-owned professional liability insurance company. And he did an interesting thing. He compared claims during this period, 1995 to 1997, to claims during a later period, 1998 to 2003. And for the purposes of our conversation, the interesting observation was that operational errors now accounted for a larger number of cases that ended up in litigation. Having to do not with misinterpretation, which has tended to be the focus when we talk about errors in surgical pathology, but lawsuits resulting from specimen or patient misidentification, the very sorts of problems that we were talking about in the pre-analytical phase of our processes. Three of them were the sorts of lost specimens that we heard about in Good Housekeeping in 2001 and again in the Chicago Sun-Times in 2008. And the world knows about floaters. Operational errors have come to the attention of the public and the lawyers. Remember, I talked about floaters. How often do they occur? This is again from a CAPQ probe study by Gordon Gephardt and Dick Zarbo. And when they looked at the rates of floaters, extraneous tissue, if you will, that ends up on a slide from a different patient, the rates were kind of surprising. The blue bars are the rates for prospective case review. In other words, the frequency with which you see floaters in routine practice and happen to notice them. So if you look at the rates per case, it's 1.5% of cases. One in 100 cases, you've got a floater that you'll notice in the case of sign-out. And if you look at whether or not the floater's near the tissue, that's true 60% of the time. And if you look at the frequency with which that poses a problem in diagnosis, the answer is not frequently. In other words, 90% of the time, it poses no diagnostic difficulty, meaning that 10% of the time, it does. If you look at the frequency of floaters in retrospectively reviewed slides, meaning slides reviewed specifically with an effort toward identifying floaters, the rates are higher, 6.2% of cases. The floaters are less frequently near the tissue, which is why it doesn't get noticed in the case of prospective review. And in nearly all cases, but not all cases, it's not the sort of tissue that poses a diagnostic problem. In other words, it's a piece of placenta on a lung biopsy, which isn't a problem. But if it's a piece of colon cancer on a transbronchial biopsy from a patient suspected of having lung cancer, a real life story, that's a problem, as it proved when this patient's pneumonectomy showed no cancer. We have other problems that are different than misinterpretation. Communication. Communication has emerged as the single most common root cause of sentinel events in medicine generally. And although we don't have the data to know this with confidence, I would argue the same is likely true of surgical pathology. In an interesting survey published in 2002 in the New England Journal, Dr. Blennon and Associates published their results of a survey in which they asked respondents about their own personal experience with medical error. And they had two kinds of respondents, those who happened to have an MD and those who didn't. And that was by design. And when they asked those folks, how often have you experienced significant medical error, either personally or an immediate member of your family, how often do you think the answer was, yes, I have? 40%. 4 out of 10 respondents said, it's happened to me. So to those who say that the New York Times, that the Wall Street Journal, that Reader's Digest is blowing things all out of proportion, I would say we've got to pay attention. This is a real problem that touches a lot of lives. And when they said to those respondents, what do you think was the cause? What do you think was a very important cause of the medical error that you and your family experienced? This is what they said, and it's interesting. The public said, number one, 72%, you don't spend enough time with me. Second, 70%, probably not a statistically significant difference, said, you're overworked, you look stressed, and you look tired. And the third most common reason was, and oh, by the way, you're lousy at teamwork. And from where I sit, you don't communicate very well with one another. Now, interestingly, if you look at the doctors who responded, that was very low. And that actually fits with my own perception and experience. It was interesting, while I was at the Mayo Clinic, there was a guy named Len Berry who has a long career at a business school in Texas, and he's made his career studying service in other sectors. And he spent a sabbatical at the Mayo Clinic because he wanted to understand service in the healthcare delivery environment. It was a new kind of change of career focus for him. And he's written about it in Fortune magazine if you want to hear his perspectives. But I was present the first time he presented to Mayo leadership, and it was kind of riveting at a number of levels. And I would argue that nowhere does healthcare happen better than at the Mayo Clinic. And he said he had an interesting experience when it came to this whole issue of communication and teamwork. He said, when I asked Mayo Clinic doctors, how do you do at teamwork? He said, they all say, we're great. He said, but when I ask the non-doctors, they say, not so good. Doctors don't think teamwork is a problem. Everybody else does. In fact, if you look at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality Surveys, and respondents are hospitals in this country, and you look at the way that respondents view the things they do well and the things they don't do so well, the thing that they do best is teamwork within their unit. And there are a number of questions that roll up to each of these headers. But number one on the list in terms of positive responses is teamwork within units. But interestingly, number 9 on the list of 12 is teamwork across units. We work great within my silo, just don't ask me to reach out and cross to the next one. And number 11 on the list of 12 was handoffs and transitions. And if you remember that stylized diagram of what happens in the analytical phase of a surgical pathology specimen, there's lots of handoffs. And I would argue we don't communicate very well across those handoffs. We're experimenting with a number of solutions to those issues in our own practice, including web-based service team calendars in which you know every member of a team engaged in a patient's care, and you can page any one of them directly from the calendar page. In February of 2003, the country was riveted by a story that wasn't surgical pathology. This happened in the clinical laboratory, and it was the story of Jessica Santian, 17, in critical care after receiving organs from the wrong donor, wrong blood type. How many of you saw this story? And most people know about this problem. In a study, in an editorial the following week, Ellen Goodman in the Boston Globe said that in Jessica's case, the cause of death was the single most common error cited in high-risk professions from aviation to medicine, and that's the failure to share key pieces of communication. We don't do that well in pathology, and I would argue the same is true in surgical pathology. She went on to say, this is what Carolyn Clancy, the then new director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, thinks of every morning when she gets her coffee. Carolyn Clancy says, it occurs to me that there's more double-checking and systematic avoidance of mistakes at Starbucks than at most healthcare institutions. Great. Your order has a better shot at being right at Starbucks than in the laboratory, was her message. If we go back to the survey from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the 2008 data, number 7 on their list of 12 was communication openness. And if you look at the specific questions that roll up to that header, staff will freely speak up if they see something that may negatively affect patient care. Only 76% gave a positive response to that question, meaning 24% felt like they couldn't speak their minds. Only 47% thought that they could challenge authority. So flow of information across authority gradients in medicine is a problem. It's exactly the problem that the aviation industry confronted in the 70s when they knew that they couldn't continue to operate at those levels of safety. And one of the root causes of their safety dilemma was the cockpit culture, in which nobody questioned the captain. And I would argue that happens in medicine all of the time. In fact, when we were rolling out our error reduction strategy at the Mayo Clinic in 2000, I was very excited about it. We were giving talks about it. We were having workshops for our employees. We were trying to get everybody engaged, and I was in a common sign-out area. And I said to the resident, if you knew I was about to go down, if you knew I was about to screw up, would you tell me? And the resident said, not a shot. I was stunned. So I said to the fellow, what about you? She said, I don't think so. So I said to the secretary that was working there, what about you? And she said, that depends. And I said, depends on what? She said, it depends on whether you're serious about all this stuff you're now saying, because historically your behavior really doesn't send me that message. I was actually the problem. I still am the problem. I work on it. But the truth is, we have an issue with communication across authority gradients. And we have an issue with how we respond to the reporting of errors. That was number 12. That was the lowest ranking item in the 2008 survey from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And when you look at the way those who work in healthcare feel about their freedom to report errors, 50% said, if I identify an error, somebody's going to hold it against me. In fact, when I do that, it feels like I'm the problem, not the error being the problem. And I think you might keep it in my file. We're doing a number of experiments to try to get at issues of communication in our own practice. We're looking at some novel communication vehicles for when there are transition points with cases. We're experimenting with this online communication form in which key elements of communication are shared whenever a case changes hands. And I would like to report that this has been remarkably successful, but it's still a work in progress. The first key is getting folks to believe that it's worth doing. And the second thing is finding ways to monitor the effect of adoption. So while misinterpretation has historically been the focus, when we think about errors in the analytical phase of our process, there are other things that disproportionately contribute to errors in practice, as reflected in this data looking at amended report frequency and what are the things underlying those amended reports. If we look at the frequency with which misinterpretation actually occurs as one form of error, the best we can do is look at diagnostic variance. And diagnostic variance, as we'll get to, is not the same thing as error, but it's the surrogate most commonly applied. So if you look at the frequency of interpretive errors in quotes, in which the process is a prospective, blinded re-review process, the rates are variable, but they're somewhere between 0.3 and 1.2% if we focus on the significant errors represented by the red bars. If we look at diagnostic variances measured from interinstitutional re-reviews, we call them transfer cases at the University of Michigan. I suspect you call them something else. That is, cases that come to you because the patient has been referred to your medical center for care, the rates are very different than what I showed you from prospective blinded re-review and range from 1.4%, the high range of the previous chart, to 5.8%, 6% of cases. And we can speculate about what those differences might be due to, but that's not really the point of our time together this morning. If you look at retrospective re-reviews, a broader set, if you will, than the interinstitutional consults, again, a number of studies published, a number of them by Dr. Robb, who's a speaker later today, and you can see that those rates vary from 0.4 to 3.2%. In fact, interestingly, Dr. Robb's most recent study showed that the rate actually depends on the driver for re-review. When the re-review is random, it's a low number. When the re-review is driven by a focused subspecialty concern about an area of risk, it may be as high as 3.2%, even in a practice that operates in a purely subspecialized fashion. And the fact that the rates of diagnostic discordance vary by the driver for re-review is not new, nor is the notion that the likelihood of patient harm varies by the driver for re-review. This is data published by Andy Renshaw a number of years ago that showed their own experience with interinstitutional consults compared to other drivers for re-review like pathologist-generated and patient or clinician-generated, and showed that in their practice, the highest rates of diagnostic discordance were those that came to them for interinstitutional re-review. But his is actually one of the few studies that then compared the diagnostic discordance to actual patient experience. And it was a very important point because he showed what everybody always knew, which was that diagnostic discordance is not the same thing as error. That when you have diagnostic discordance, you're stuck with the problem of who's right and who's wrong. And very few studies actually link that to actual patient outcome. And when Andy did that, and these are the various categories for the driver for the re-review, their interinstitutional consults, those that were generated by the pathologist, those that were generated by a patient or a clinician, and if you looked at those cases for which you had outcome data and looked at the number of diagnostic discordances that were actually errors, the number was variable. And he drew the conclusion that diagnostic disagreement is not the same as error, but it's kind of the best we have. And this is where clinicians get very confused, and I would argue we should not. Because what we do is a difficult business. And while much of the world thinks that misinterpretation should be a black or white issue, we know that it's more complex. But understanding the complexity of interpretation is difficult. So I'm going to show you a simple exercise that I think makes the point. So all you have to do, and this is open to everybody, you don't have to be a pathologist to do this. All you have to do is count the number of times the team in white, do you see them? The number of times they pass the basketball. And what could be simpler than that, right? Now, as you watch this, there are a couple of rules. One, you must do it in silence. I want you to give no clues, audible or physical, to the person next to you. Right? This is a solo task. Watch the white team, count the number of times they pass the ball. And then, it's not that I'm not trusting. I am, by and large. But then I want you to write down the number of times you saw them pass the ball. That's just to keep everybody honest. Now, you would think with a group like this, we ought to all get that right. All you have to do is count the number of times they pass the ball, right? Is there anybody who doesn't understand what I'm asking you to do? And you would think we ought to all come up with the same number. And I will tell you that if you all come up with the same number, I will not charge Bruce for my expenses, nor will I accept his honorarium. How about that? Good with you, Bruce? The white people will only pass. See, now he wants to know the rules. Right? Now there's money on the table. Yeah, wait a minute here. The white team will only pass to the white team, and the black team will only pass to the black team. And all you have to do is count the number of times the white team passes the ball. You know, like this. One, two, three. You with me? And Bruce wants you to get this right. Everybody ready? No talking to your neighbor. No physical clues to your neighbor. Just watch the video. Count the number of times the white team passes the ball. Here we go. Should be easy. Okay, good luck, Bruce. Write it down. How many said 15? Well, that's a problem, because I only see four hands. How many saw 16? Sorry, Bruce, it's going to cost you. How many saw 17? How many saw less than 15? How many saw more than 17? So we've got a range of 15 to over 17, and all you had to do was count the number of times they passed the ball. Interpretation is complex. By the way, did anybody see anything else? What'd you see? Yeah? You saw a gorilla. How many saw a gorilla? How many didn't see a gorilla? So a bunch of people didn't see a gorilla. Well, it must be subtle. Let's look again. I'm sure it's subtle. After all, you get paid for seeing things. Surely you wouldn't miss anything obvious. Must be subtle. Still no gorilla. Oh. Oh, that is subtle. Yeah. Wow. A room full of pathologists and we couldn't see a gorilla. By the way, the first time I saw this, I didn't see the gorilla either. And I figured the person showing me this video was a liar. But I now know that he wasn't. This is something called inattentional blindness for dynamic events. It's an issue of perception. This is talked about in psychology literature. But with this exercise, half of observers, so on average, half of observers, look like what the experience was in this room, fail to notice this ongoing, highly salient, but unexpected event while being asked to monitor something else. And I would argue that it happens all the time in surgical pathology. In fact, they're more likely to notice the unexpected event if the events are visually similar to the events to which they are attending. In other words, if you tell a room like this to watch the black team, you'll see the gorilla. Isn't that interesting? But if you watch the white team, you'll miss it. Different color. Thirdly, these things can pass through the spatial extent of attentional focus and not be seen if they're not specifically being attended. I would argue that happens all the time in pathology. How does it happen? A clinician says, this has to be Wegener's, the C-ANC is positive. You see Wegener's. You don't see the AFB. Right? Happens all the time. A clinician says, this has to be cancer. And suddenly those reactive epithelial cells look a lot like cancer, even when they're not. By the way, this is influenced by alcohol. I'm not saying that applies this morning in Las Vegas. But just so you know, if you redo this exercise and you tell the participants they got alcohol and half do and half don't, the half that do see the gorilla 18% of the time rather than 42% of the time. And if you tell participants they're getting tonic, those who actually get alcohol instead, same experience. So, again, I'm not saying that that applies to this morning, but this varies by alcohol consumption. So, given that, it can't be as simple as having cases re-reviewed twice. We have to think about other things, like anticipating the predictable. Meaning, if the QA data in your practice says that there's an area of risk, you have to put in place tools to make sure that you mitigate that risk. At Suncoast, they've done that by saying things like, all prostate needle biopsies will be seen by at least two of them, meaning if from this screen a pathologist tries to verify a report on a prostate needle and they know that only one person's seen it, it won't let you. It says you're not done. Andy Renshaw showed the impact of prospectively reviewing a subset of cases when he compared the rates of discordance on re-review between those cases seen by a single pathologist and those cases seen by at least two pathologists. The rates of discordance dropped in a statistically significant fashion, and although not statistically significant, the rates of amended reports were also clearly different. So find ways to anticipate the predictable. Find ways to measure real-time diagnostic trends, which won't necessarily tell you there's a problem, but they tell you where to look. In this idealized, fabricated diagram, using a tool that they use at Suncoast, they monitor on a daily basis Gleason scores for prostate needles. And they can see what the trends are. They can see if one of them is suddenly starting to grade prostate needles differently. It doesn't tell you what's right or wrong. It simply tells you there's an opportunity for discovery to make the practice better. So, what are the countermeasures that make sense for errors in the analytical phase? Some of them overlap with those things that make sense for the pre-analytical phase. You have to have a plan, application of lean principles and tools, electronic positive patient identification tools at multiple fiduciary tracking points, and aspiring to a culture of safety, which means learning to communicate across authority gradients, and I would argue we have a lot of work to do there, and learning how to engage and embrace reporting of errors as an opportunity for improvement. It means thinking about forced functions predicated on specific QA initiatives, So, for example, selected prospective re-review. And I would argue in many practices we don't do that very well. I was at a practice that will remain unnamed, very good place, very safety conscious, where they had a problem with one breast case. Their solution was to have every breast case reviewed by two pathologists, no matter what. And I said, well, when you say no matter what, you don't mean reduction mammoplasties, do you? And the answer was, yeah, absolutely. I would argue that's not efficient. Remember, the Institute of Medicine's second report said safety can't come at the cost of effectiveness and efficiency. So I would argue mostly we haven't been very good at thinking of data-driven ways to manage this. Real-time monitoring of diagnostic trends. Delivery of just-in-time case-specific content, meaning as you go to release that endometrial biopsy, a window that pops up and says, just asking, do you really remember how to FIGO grade? Because the rules have changed. And finally, and this is important, a commitment to service. Sometimes I think we see service as separate from safety and quality when it comes to the analytical phase of our process. When it comes to thinking about the analytical phase of our process and doing something about errors, we kind of focus on this part of lean, error-proofing, surfacing problems, etc. But I would argue that a focus on service is equally important, and there's now growing data about that. That if you look at organizations and hospitals that prioritize service as a strategic imperative, they actually experience fewer errors. And the other issue about service is discovering a problem today rather than 3 weeks from today, creates greater opportunities for root cause discovery, and it happens at lower cost. So turnaround time is important when you talk about error. It's also important in the eyes of those we serve. Pathologists sometimes poo-poo the importance of turnaround time, blaming it on the customer. They don't need it yet. It's actually not about us, right? And if you ask those we serve, as Dick Zarbo did in this study on customer satisfaction for the users of our services, and you looked at the way those users rank their satisfaction with various attributes of what we provide, timeliness of reporting was at the bottom of the list. We don't do that well. In fact, we did it really poorly at the University of Michigan. I would argue we're doing it much better. I can prove it. But we went through a process that was a year long, started in the summer of 06, and we really did a process map for our complex system. And we documented that process in pictures, and we plastered the walls of our conference room with these pictures so that everyone could be engaged in the dialogue. And the problem was this. These were pictures taken in our practice in August of 2006. This was one of our sign-out rooms. That's a problem. That was the work that had been done the day before. And when I looked at that stack of cases, what was interesting to me was that these patients had come to us on Thursday and Friday. Why the difference? Didn't make sense to me. When I went down to our room one, the area that you saw in one of the videos, at 7 o'clock the next morning, together with my colleague Dan Vischer, our director of surgical pathology, we saw an interesting dilemma. These were cases that had been delivered to our gross room but not accessioned. These were cases that had been delivered to our gross room and had been accessioned but hadn't been grossed. And these were cassettes from cases that had been grossed but never made it to the processor. We started every morning 70 patients down. Yeah, wow, that was my response. This was clearly an issue of batch processing, which we usually blame on our suppliers, but we knew that that was the opportunity. It was really the front end of our process that was the problem. We went through a large PDCA cycle. The first part of doing something was to put together a cross-functional design team, which really included the people doing the work. And I asked them to redesign the process for gross examination of our specimens to ensure continuous flow, nobody would idle, to ensure the right expertise for the right specimen at the right time, and in the process to also not abandon our commitment to research and to procure tissues. We did lots of things. We changed the way specimens were assigned to histotechs and PAs. We changed the way that PAs and residents were partnered to provide continuous coverage for all of our services. So we went to a model that looked more like this, in which all of our subspecialty practices had continuous coverage throughout the day, and we knew who was accountable. And we scheduled those rotations based on our understanding of specimen delivery times and where our peaks and valleys were. We suffered a shortage of grossing stations, so we tried to do some workload leveling and put the right services in the right grossing stations based on what we understood of specimen volumes and delivery times. And we did that at the back end. When I got there, all of our signouts were in the morning because that was most convenient for doctors, but it's actually not about us. So we staggered our signouts. We changed our algorithm for accessioning cases. Before, cases were accessioned to services. It's hard to hold a service accountable. So we shifted our model to accessioning cases to specific faculty to improve our ability to case track, but also to minimize handoffs, and it actually allowed us to drive expectations for a case turnaround time. And we did workload leveling in both the histology laboratory and transcription with clearly articulated priorities for each service. So histotechs, PAs, staggered signouts, staggered utilization of grossing stations, accession cases to specific faculty, and align the priorities in our core operations. And key is we then handed that design off to a group that could make it happen. But I think too often what we do is ask the folks to design the solution to also implement it, and their different skills and their different levels of authorities, they're not the same thing. So we handed off the design to a group that was accountable for implementing, and they did lots of things. They put together modules for training our histotechnologists who prior to this time did not grow specimens, put together competency documentation. It required an incremental position. We realigned reporting relationships for our PAs who prior to that time had two different reporting relationships. They had a whole new schedule, a whole new staffing model. We had to develop lots of policies and make them work. We worked very closely with our pathology data systems who developed multiple new functionalities, including the web-based calendars that I showed you earlier. And we communicated and communicated and communicated. This was a transformational event for us at the University of Michigan. So the project design team was a cross-functional team, and every participant was tasked with communicating with those in their work areas. I mentioned the AP Laboratory Operations Group, also a cross-functional team tasked with the same thing, and this was their primary agenda item in February, April, May, June, July, August, the month we went live, and September, the first month following our go live. It was a major agenda item at faculty meetings in January, February, April, July, and September after we went live. And it was a major item in my weekly emailed newsletter in January, February, March, April, May, April, June, July, August, and again in September. I had lunch with the residents to hear and learn from their concerns, and I had breakfast with the accessioning and histology personnel. And despite this, when we went live on August 1st, I had an irate faculty member come into my office and say, "What the hell's going on?" So just when you think you've communicated enough, communicate some more. We made the go-live date a special day, which means food in our environment. I suspect the same is true for you. So we provided food, and we had everyone was welcome. We had physicians, we had techs, we had our IT folks. This is Kathy Davis. And we created space to openly share ideas as the problems emerged. In other words, key to our message was, we know we didn't get this right. We know that. So your job is to tell us where we got it wrong and help us to design alternatives. It's very important that you say, we got it wrong. But we're going to try it anyway, and it will get better. And we had support from the top. This is our chair, this is our chief administrator. And they were present in that space that day. So from day one, we were evaluating the consequences, and from day one, it was impressive. This is the space where I showed you all those queued up specimens. We'd never seen this surface before, right? We were continuously processing specimens. And since then, now well over a year, we've spent our time finding ways to adopt and standardize and improve on those processes, and it worked. If we look at the impact on turnaround time for those services that were affected, there was a dramatic decrease despite an increase in volume. So we didn't do this because we had less work to do. If you look at the impact on specific services affected by this transformation, in some of our services, this is breast, we reduced turnaround time by nearly 60%. And in case you think that doesn't matter, a surgeon stopped me in the hallway a month into this and said, "You have changed the way we care for patients, and our patients have noticed." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "A patient who is the wife of a faculty member at the university came to me for her follow-up appointment and was stunned that I had the result." And she said, "I'd been told pathology was a problem here." Right? And she said to the surgeon, "I'm going to tell all of my friends." So if you think you don't make a difference, it makes a difference. Turnaround time matters. And we're doing it at less cost. Histotechs, who prior to this time grossed none of our service, now gross 60% of our patients. allowing our PAs to do the sorts of specimens for which they were most uniquely trained to do. And our histology laboratory, who started here in its ability to deliver on expectations, now operates in a highly efficient fashion. And we do it at less cost. This is what's happened to our overtime, which has not only been diminished dramatically, but is a more controlled process. We still have work to do. If you look at the number of accession ungross cases in our practice per week, it's kind of a steady number at about 120. And our model fully deployed should say that number should be zero. Well, finally, what about post-analytical phase errors? And this is one I think we tend to dismiss because we view it as someone else's problem. But how can it be someone else's problem when transforming tissue into information is what we do? And the truth is, our vehicle for communication is a lousy vehicle with which we've been content for decades. This is an article that came from Yale a number of years ago. Clinicians are from Mars and pathologists are from Venus. Clinician interpretation of pathology reports. Why did it take until 2000 for someone to ask, I wonder if these work? The author said, and this was really driven by an unanticipated experience to a new report format, contrary to our original hypothesis, our modified anatomic pathology report formats reduced comprehension when compared to our hospital system standard report. They go on to say, the problem of report comprehension warrants exploration. Wow. So what they did was pretty simple. They had six different reports, each one in three different formats, and they gave participants, and the participants fell into three experience categories, students, house staff, and attendings, all surgeons. And the questionnaire had questions that required only one of three responses, yes, no, or not stated. Perfect for a surgical audience. So this was the old format. This was the new format that they thought would be better, turned out to be worse. And this was a modernized version of the historical format. And they looked at rates of discordance, discordance meaning that the response from the surgeon was not the anticipated response. They said no when it should have been yes. And when they looked at rates of discordance across these various forms of report formats, it was interesting. And if you just look at the summary number, on average, there was a 30% discordant rate. 30% of the time, our reports conveyed information that was not understood in the way it was intended. And misunderstanding, these are the 27 questions on the questionnaire, had little to do with rates of certainty. For each set of questions for each report, there was a final question that asked the respondent to gauge their level of certainty. Oh, I'm very certain about the way I'm seeing this report. I'm not so certain I'm seeing this report. And the truth was, they could be very wrong and very confident. I'm certain this is what they meant. And it turns out it's not at all what we meant. Paul Valenstein more recently has said, we need to learn from other disciplines about the way to convey information. And I would say the challenge today is we now have multiple ways to communicate. The paper report isn't it anymore. There are electronic reports. There are emails. There are text messages. There are pages. But he said we should think about diagnostic headlines to emphasize key points. We should maintain layout continuity, both between specimen types, between specialties, and over time. We should optimize information density. We should get rid of clutter. We should minimize corruption of formatting when it's shunted across an interface to another place. So here he showed the same information formatted differently and using diagnostic headlines. And here he showed four different ways to present the same information, but in variable ways that allows it to be more easily digested. So one thing we should do is simplify and standardize reports designed in collaboration with those who use them. And the final thing is we have to learn to communicate differently. The report by itself is insufficient. If we go back to the survey of our users, they're very unhappy with our frequency, with the way in which we notify significant abnormal results. This is really the issue of communicating critical diagnoses, which happens in the clinical laboratories, but it happens in surgical pathology too. This is a recent publication from Thelma Pereira and colleagues looking at a survey of respondents and what their practices were for communicating critical values. And it was kind of stunning to me. They had three categories of response: phone call as soon as possible, phone call within 24 hours, and routine report delivery. And when they asked, well, what about vasculitis, 55% said as soon as possible, 30% said 24 hours should do, 15% said any time will do. When they said, what about neoplasms causing paralysis? That sounds important. 20% said any time will do, 20% said 24 hours ought to be fine, and 60% said that sounds like an emergency. Can you imagine if it were you or your family member whose legs were beginning to not work, and you said, where's the PATH report? And someone said, we'll get it in the next 2 or 3 days. A new diagnosis of malignancy with clinical suspicion. Now, most people said, if there's a clinical suspicion, routine report delivery should do. But in an editorial, Dan Vischer cautioned and said, in today's fractured patient care settings with off-site pathology laboratories and specialized surgery centers, communication becomes an increasingly complex problem. If our diagnosis fails to reach the appropriate medical provider, or the patient for that matter, should we agree that a routine but missed cancer diagnosis becomes a critical value? What does he mean by that? If a primary care provider refers a 72-year-old woman to a gastroenterologist for routine screening colonoscopy, and the gastroenterologist, based on what they saw at the time of endoscopy, writes on the PATH report, rule out cancer, we say the cancer diagnosis is an expected diagnosis. But for whom? For the gastroenterologist, not the primary care provider. And guess who's going to see the patient in follow-up? In this case, as it turns out, a year later. The primary care provider, for whom this is a very unexpected diagnosis, one that he didn't know about for 12 months. And our response was to blame them. Well, it said rule out cancer. Who were we to know? And I would argue that's our job. So we have a critical values alerts policy. I'm not going to go through the details. It's like everybody else's. But the point is, once you've defined for yourself what you think are critical values, you need a process to validate those against clinical concerns. In this case, for us, it was our executive committee for clinical affairs. So in our practice, critical alert values are urgently communicated. We have a daily report, and there are two. Our PATH data systems developed a protocol that scans our database for diagnoses that look like they might be within the purview of our critical values alerts policy. And then they look for language that suggests it's been communicated. And if it looks like it might be a critical value and there's no language to suggest it's been communicated, it shows up on this report. And one report goes to signing faculty. These are generated every day, and they canvass cases signed out in the previous 24 hours. And then there's a management report of all cases that go to either me or Dan Vischer. What Dan and I do is then reconcile those reports against the electronic medical record to see whether, in fact, they were communicated and not documented, or whether, in fact, they weren't communicated and should have been. We then use that to provide feedback to the signing faculty and to communicate in real time. If you look at our experience in 07, 08, and 09 over the same period, January 1st through March 13, we've kind of achieved a steady state in terms of the number of cases that surface on our report. When you look at the number of those cases that actually merit attention or action on either Dan or my part, there may be a trend downward, which may suggest that we're getting better. So the final thing that I leave you with in terms of specific solutions to problems in the post-analytical phase are ways to communicate critical values, and I would argue we ought to be more broad in how we define critical values. By way of review, specific solutions for the analytical phase include having a formal written plan for error detection and problem resolution, perhaps application of lean principles and tools, electronic positive patient identification at multiple fiduciary tracking points. You must aspire to a culture of safety, which has a lot of elements, including communication across authority gradients and error reporting. You need to find ways to force functions predicated on specific QA initiatives tailored to your own practice. You need to find ways to monitor your own diagnostic trends in real time. Delivery of just-in-time case-specific comment and a commitment to service, which is linked to safety. And in the pre-analytical phase, again, you need a formal written plan. Again, lean principles and tools can apply. Provider order entry is relatively unexplored in the surgical pathology arena, but holds promise. Again, electronic positive patient identification and software solutions that maintain fidelity of patient ID across key handouts. My hope is that over the last hour and 15 minutes, I've helped you understand the problem of safety and quality in surgical pathology. I've left you with an understanding that this isn't about bad people, it's about systems, and that only systems-based thinking will bring us to where we need to be. And I hope I've given you some ideas about specific solutions to common problems in surgical pathology quality and safety. Thank you for your attention. 5 minutes worth of questions, and then we'll have a break. 5 minutes of questions. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, so great question. So the question is, what were some of the challenges in the changes that we implemented August 1st? And there were lots of them. Many of the changes we made were really huge cultural shifts for this practice. One of them, for example, histotechnologist training, now grossing. As it turns out, there was a time in Michigan's history when they did that, and that went away for reasons unclear to me. But there was a lot of resistance to making that change. So we did a number of things. One, we tied it actually to an incentive program for our histotechnologists, so they can make more money by grossing specimens. We did that somewhat cautiously and advisedly because you don't want to make it about the money, but we wanted to provide an incentive. We had to do a lot in terms of managing the dynamic between histotechnologists and PAs, which wasn't a healthy dynamic before, and this risked making it worse. I would argue that now if you walk into our gross rooms, that's been totally transformed, but it wasn't easy. Two of the PAs that we had then are now gone, and actually the supervisor in that area that we had then is now gone. Now, I don't want to make it sound like that should be a common response to problems. In fact, I think it's a last resort. But it was very important to us to send a message that we were serious and this was non-negotiable. So, for example, on the go-live date, it turns out that histotechnology grossing was not happening in the way that we had envisioned. And it turned out that that was an issue of laboratory management that had to be addressed. I mean, you can't walk away from tough problems or tough conversations. So we did those things. We did a number of things at the physician level. And I would argue there's where our success has been most mediocre. We had kind of management solutions for the non-physician side that are harder to apply on the physician side, but you have to apply them nonetheless. So, for example, one of the things we did that was really big was assigning cases to specific faculty. Prior to that time in our practice, when you walked away from a sign-out service on Friday, you were done, even if there were dangling patients in cases. And somebody else would clean them up on Monday or Tuesday. Theoretically, that no longer occurs in our practice. In fact, it still happens a lot. And it's very hard for me to measure that. So I measure it by walking around. And I measure it when a resident brings me a case that should be someone else's, and I go have a conversation. So I think that's been, from my perspective, the biggest challenge has been managing physician expectation and participation, and that remains a work in progress. And at some point, I think you also have to put teeth into that. You have to tie that. I know, for example, that Dick Zarbo at Henry Ford has tied participation in Lean to their incentive program. I don't want to go there yet at the University of Michigan, but it's not out of bounds, I don't think. I think you have to send a message to all participants that this is how we're going to care for patients. I don't know if that answered your question. Frank. Good question. Do we have residents other than pathology residents doing grossing and sign out? And the answer is no. Yes, sir. Good question. So now that we've fully automated patient identification, have we seen unexpected outcomes? We have not fully automated patient identification. So what I showed you in that video is our very first step in that direction. So we haven't brought it. So our next steps are to bring that process for cassette generation to each grossing station. So the devices you saw, we're going to put at each grossing station. So that rather than batching printing of cassettes based on the accessioner's anticipation of what the need might be, they'll be generated in a just-in-time fashion, case by case, at the grossing station. We haven't gone there yet, and that'll all be barcode-driven. We haven't gotten it to the histotech cutting stations yet. So, I mean, we are not there yet. Yeah. And I would say no, but this is very early. Yul, when did we go live with that? It's only been there about a month. 6 or 7 weeks. So I haven't really measured. So I don't have that yet. We're very early in this journey. Yes, sir. Yep. Yep. So good question. There were a lot of moving parts, and maybe that wasn't the best strategy in retrospect. We did change a lot all at once. And as I think about it and reflect on it, to be honest, I don't know why that was true, but I'll tell you why it might have been true. So I went to the University of Michigan in January of 06, and I decided for myself that I'd spend the first year being quiet so that when change came, I know it was funny. Frank knows me. So really my reason was I wanted to understand, and when change came, I wanted it to feel like it was being done from the inside out and not the outside in. But after a year of being quiet, I could hardly contain myself. There was so much we needed to do. So maybe it was too big a project. On the other hand, a lot of those pieces stuck. So I would say about, I'm just making this up, but I'd say about 70 to 80% of what went live that day was a very steady state within 3 months. And about 20% didn't stick. And so we continue to work on that. In terms of the actual go-live event that you referenced, that was actually very carefully planned. Because long before it went live, we were already getting the negative feedback, because that's how people respond to change. We have great people. I don't want to convey any other message, but we knew it was a challenge. And the most important reason for us to have a celebratory go-live date was to make it feel positive, and to really mitigate any potential negative backlash. When you put a poster out in front of the room, say, come tell us how we screwed up, it kind of disarms folks. You know, I mean, if they come through the door and say, man, you got this piece wrong, we could smile and say, awesome, tell us what it was. Right? I mean, you were there, Yul. Is that a fair assessment? Yeah. And actually, I would say it was pretty fun. And we did some things that I was told we couldn't do. You know, when I went to administration and said I want to buy Michigan baseball hats to make it feel like a team sport, they said you can't do that, so I did it anyway. When they said I want to buy food, they said you can't do that, I did it anyway. You know, I mean, you just have to. And we got more people engaged. So I walked around with those hats. I went to the folks in the surgical suite, non-pathology folks at the main desk there, and I said, you don't know us, but we're having a big day today, and I'd like to give you some hats, and I'd like you to know what's going on in the lab next door. And so I mean, actually, I think that was a key step. Having that sort of celebration. And it really was the beginning of data monitoring in a way that continues to this moment. And really, I think it was key in transforming the culture. I'll tell you a way that I knew that. Prior to that, our histology laboratory had very little data about their operations, which was frightening to me. And there was a lot of fear about having data because it felt like folks were going to be held accountable. And data has become a way of life for them. In fact, I didn't realize how much it become a way of life for them until about 6 months later when, for a variety of reasons, the data that was being generated daily did not get posted for a week. And there was an uproar. The histotechnologist says, how are we supposed to know how we're doing if you don't show us the data? It was amazing to me. Here was a group that had started by saying, actually, you don't need the data. We're doing a great job. That's all you need to know. Went from that to, how are we supposed to know? You didn't give us the data. So I would say the dynamic in the work areas has changed dramatically. And I think you have to recognize that. So one of the things we did was we had a huge employee recognition dinner at a great restaurant locally, the sort of place, you know, a lot of those folks never eat. One of the coolest things was a lot of those employees said to me afterward, wow, I only see food like this on the Food Channel. We rented the restaurant on a Sunday when they're normally closed. I know the chef quite well. He made a spectacular dinner paired with wine for this group of employees. We had a huge event, and I'm telling you, I now have people who walk through fire for me. So I think when they respond in that fashion, you have to reward them. Again, I was told I couldn't do that, and I did it anyway. So you have to think outside the box, and you have to do novel things, and I would say that what we're doing now in terms of transforming our patient care is real energizing for everybody. One of the employees said to me the next day, are you going to do this again next year? I said, depends.